Atheist Nomads, episode 205, The Committee to Nominate the Nominating Committee.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin.
I'm Lauren.
Yeah, and Wesley's not with us.
That's okay, because Lauren's here.
Mm-hmm. So, Lauren, how have you been?
Pregnant.
Yay.
I know, I say that every time. No, things have been getting better. Stressed out about work, but who isn't?
Yeah, I'm also stressed out about work. My workload went from being about 2 hours a week to now 50 hours that I'm having to try to cram into 40. And now I think I can finally go for 60 hours of work fitting into 50.
Oh, yay, overtime.
Yeah, realistically, between now and, well, the time the baby's born and I take a week off, I will probably be getting overtime more weeks than not.
See, this is my argument that he should let me go ahead and quit my job so that I can be a homemaker while he's doing all this overtime hours. And then the little voice in the back of my head is like, you're not going to do that. I'm like, shut up, voice.
Right, yeah.
I can totally make dinner on time and clean the house and do laundry. And oh my God, that's a lot of work.
Right, yeah, yeah. You can totally, you know, sit on the couch and watch Mystery Science Theater 3000 and then freak out when I send you the text that I'm coming home.
Yep. Panic and get everything done in 20 minutes.
Yep. Yep.
That's the way things... Yeah. Yeah. So I don't see the downside here.
Oh, man. All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump right on into dusting off the degree. With the busyness at work, there have been lots of meetings, including some meetings that have been meetings to plan meetings. Like, literally, a meeting gets called to schedule, well, figure out, A, who do you need to have in this meeting you need to have, and what time works for everybody? And it's like, come on, seriously? But it also reminded me of Adventist governance. I've talked about it a little bit before as far as the hierarchy. And it's really easy to look at the Adventist Church as a top-down hierarchy with the General Conference President, and then the General Conference, and then you have the division presidents, and then the division level, and then you have the union conference presidents, and then the union level, and then you have the conference president, and then the conference level, and then the pastor and the church. But the power really comes from the bottom up.
That's insane, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. It is the most structured religious organization in the world, with more levels of bureaucracy than the Catholic Church has.
Take now, that, Catholics.
The Catholics have more bureaucratic organizations, but not more levels of defined bureaucracy. Yeah, and the Mormons are also quite bureaucratic, but nothing like that. But the power is actually bottom-up. And if you didn't know anything about Adventism, and you just showed up when it's time to select the next year's church officers, a process that usually takes 4 months, you would think that their religion is representative democracy and that their Bible is Robert's Rules of Order.
Uh-huh.
Not newly revised, the original version. Yes, because they are, they're originalists, I think. No, they probably, when they do use Robert's Rules, probably do follow the current version, as most do. And I love Robert's Rules. I absolutely do. But the whole process starts, and the church I grew up in never did this right, which meant the whole process took about 6 weeks. 6 weeks versus 4 months. You're supposed to have business meetings once a month. There's board meetings once a month, but then there's also business meetings where the church members come together to discuss church business. Things like the budget and decide, make membership decisions that aren't tied to just a baptism, and also to take care of things like new church officers. And my church growing up had all of, I think, 3 business meetings the entire time. One of which had to be mediated by the conference vice president. Yeah, that one was when I was in college. That was fun. I lectured everyone on how they had screwed everything up while I was away. It was glorious. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So the process typically starts with a business meeting, usually chaired by the head elder, where they take nominations from the floor to nominate people for the committee to nominate the nominating committee. So
one more time.
They call for nominations for people to go onto the committee to nominate the nominating committee.
Okay. Okay. Three levels of
nominations.
Nominations there. Wow.
So they call for the nominations, they get the nominations, and then at the business meeting, they vote in the committee to nominate the nominating committee. And that group gets together and they look at the church members, and there's this, like, everybody wants to be on the committee to nominate the nominating committee, and nobody wants to be on the nominating committee. Because the job of the committee to nominate the nominating committee is done as soon as you have a nominating committee. The job of the nominating committee doesn't end until a new nominating committee is selected. Because
so you have the choice between 4 months or a year of service?
Actually, 1 month.
Oh, okay. Oh,
well,
I
usually
see.
One, maybe two.
I see why people are.
And if you want to hold a church office and you're on the nominating committee, you can't. At least it's highly discouraged, because you don't want to nominate yourself. But if you are on the committee to nominate the nominating committee, then you can nominate. Well, you can then get nominated by the nominating committee to hold church office.
Right, because you would still never nominate yourself. That's right. So gauche.
Yeah. And since you can't nominate yourself, if you get on the committee to nominate the nominating committee, you're guaranteed to not be on the nominating committee. Unless you have a church with 7 members, in which case...
Everybody's on the nominating committee.
There's no such thing. Everyone's an officer. Everyone's the nominating committee. Everyone's the business meeting. And yeah, that gets crazy. Actually, in those churches, it's usually one elder, one deacon. So you have the 2 church officers. Treasurer, you have 3. So in a 7-member church, 3/7 are officers.
Have to be officers.
Yep. The church clerk. Okay, 4 out of 7. And if you really want to give everybody an office, the head organist and head pianist.
Yeah, those are obviously like not that important.
Oh, my grandma was very proud of the fact that she was the head organist for the Vail Seventh-day Adventist Church for like 50 years. There was 2 generations of aspiring head organists who had to wait and be her junior.
That would suck. Wait your entire life. You're like, surely she'll pass it on sometime, this generation.
Like my my grandpa was an elder for, I think, 30 or 40 years, and then retired from that. My grandma, she held on to that until like 85, and then she still played the organ half the time. I think right up until her stroke. But this is also still getting off the point. The committee to nominate the nominating committee nominates the nominating committee, and then they have to present their report to the next business meeting. And the church membership can either vote to accept the entire slate or reject it. It's just a straight up or down vote. If it gets voted up, which is what happens 99.99999% of the time, then the job of the committee to nominate the nominating committee is done, and they can go back to just being normal church members. And then the nominating committee starts, which is a process that usually takes a month. It can take more, where they pray and they meet over and over, and they look over who the members are and who has offices and who could be a good person to take an office, and they look at the kids and see who should be good junior deacons and deaconesses, and have to fill all the Sabbath school classes, which the teachers for those have a high rate of burnout. And then as they pick people, they have to then actually go and talk to them and ask them if they are willing. I remember when I was 13 and
getting interviewed,
I got asked if I was willing to become a junior deacon. Actually, I think it was at 12. I wasn't even a member yet.
They're desperate.
No, it would have been at 13. Yeah, because they had to be a member first. So yeah, they did wait till after I was baptized. But so then you have to ask everybody. And then once everybody has agreed, and if somebody says no, you ask somebody to be a deacon and he says no. That's stupid. I don't want to do that. Then they have to go back and try again. And they have to do this until they have every office filled, including ones that we're currently in. They get to pick whether they want to keep those people or not. And then if that takes a month, then at the next business meeting, they present that and everybody votes up or down. And if they take more than a month, then they take more than a month. And when they get to that last meeting, It's an up or down vote for the full slate. If it's down on the full slate, then they can either go one by one through the offices and elect people in that way, or they can then split it up to refer it back to the committee and they have to try again.
That second option sounds awful.
Especially since nobody is going to say why they voted no.
Yeah.
But the odds of actually getting a majority to vote no without any of them knowing beforehand that that's going to happen is so slim.
Nobody's going to rock the boat.
Right, right. Nobody would do that. So then so this process seems ridiculous and like something that would only work at the local level. Nope. It happens at the conference level, the union conference level, the division level, and the general conference.
So basically anybody who's a member is in some kind of position.
No.
Because it seems like that's an awful lot of positions.
The average Adventist church has about 80 members. It is actually, even though you're not supposed to, it is pretty common for members of the nominating committee to already hold church office. You'll usually have a couple of elders and a couple of deacons on there, usually a deaconess, maybe the treasurer. And so there ends up being a lot of overlap where they're trying to fill the other positions. And because every rule you have in a truly democratic organization can be overridden, especially any procedural rule, you can always override that. And it can get to the point where the rule doesn't even really exist because it gets overridden every time. And they just stop overriding it because it doesn't matter.
Well, it just sounds like any like other organization that I've ever been a part of where you just want to be a member, but they manage to like loop you into some kind of leadership role anyway because they're so desperate for it.
Oh, that... my church growing up had a total of, I think, 120 members. And we had easily 20 people who held church office, probably closer to 25. And during nominating committee time, that number would balloon to close to 50.
Oh.
Between the two committees.
Wow.
So almost half the church membership would be involved in something at some point. For the higher levels, they don't just send members. Like, not anybody can just go. Each church picks delegates to go to the conference. And then at a conference, they pick delegates to go to the union conference. And then they pick delegates to...
Et cetera.
Well, general conference, definitely. The divisions, they exist, but they don't. They're kind of in this weird quasi-existent state. They're technically just a part of the GC. So the same rules don't completely apply at that level. Kind of do. But the whole power process is bottom up. It is all incredibly democratic. Conceivably, it's incredibly unpredictable, although it usually goes exactly how you expect. And, oh yeah, it can just be weird. And this goes so far that with the power being held at the local level, there was a heretic that everybody wanted to get out of the church. They fired him from his tenured teaching position at an Adventist university. This is in the 80s. I forget his name, but he's Australian and he was anti Ellen White and they tried to kick him out. They took away his ordination. They took him off the church payroll. He almost got voted out of his church membership when a church in North Dakota offered to take his membership and refused to remove it.
Wow.
And he's been on the books ever since because membership is held at the local level.
Oh.
And all membership decisions are democratic. And technically, to transfer, you have to have a first and second reading on the transfer at the losing church, supposed to be at business meetings, with a motion, a second, and a majority vote. And you have to have the second reading with a motion, a second, and a majority vote.
I hate Robert's rules.
And then on the receiving end, once the membership has been released, you have to repeat the process to accept the person.
It's just, how does anything get done?
They usually skip some of it. So like the first reading usually happens just at church. And for membership changes, often they'll just do it at church services. So it's 1 week and then the next week. One of the rare ones that tends to stick with business meetings is removal of membership. Where when I resigned my membership with the Adventist Church, I had to contact the church in Michigan that I transferred my membership to when I was working with them when I was in the seminary, and I had to request that they remove my membership, and they had to put that on the agenda for the next business meeting. There had to be a motion and a second and a majority vote to remove me and my membership. And
what if they just wanted to screw with you? And
they could have. They could have refused to remove my membership. If they had, I would have responded with, actually, because I still had a copy of the church manual, I would have quoted page, chapter, page, and paragraph from the church manual. The at that point, 5 of the 7, actually, I think it's closer to 13. 7 out of 13, I think is what it was, mandatory reasons to remove somebody's membership.
Ah, and you definitely qualified.
I qualified under at least 7.
Yeah.
Drinking alcohol is one of them.
Sip.
Yes, I'm drinking beer. Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and take a break, and then we'll be back with news and maybe somebody joining us. We will see.
By Archway Hosting. Check out their low-price, full-featured hosting solutions at archwayhosting.com. That's ARCHWAY hosting.com.
Hey, we're also brought to you by listeners just like you. Find out how you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. That's patreon.com/atheistnomads.
It's finished up their spring session and are going into recess for the summer.
And what a session it was.
And that actually sounds kind of like school. They have a fall and a spring session. They take the summers and winters off.
Yeah, sounds kind of nice.
It's kind of like a school schedule, but they're usually busy working through most of that. And also, they're almost all old.
That is, yeah.
Most of them should be retired, except for you, Ginsburg.
Never, ever retire.
Over your own cold, dead body. No, that sounds
That's
weird.
That's morbid,
that
man.
Is weird.
You got dark fast.
Sorry. No, she has... Like, we're going to need a weekend at Bernie's with her.
I don't know.
On the bench.
Yeah, yeah.
But
sunglasses and a Hawaiian shirt.
She's a woman. She seems as stubborn as my grandma. I give her another good 10, 15 years.
I have no opinion.
Yeah. I'm not a doctor and not her doctor, so I have no grounds to say that. But anyway, the Supreme Court lifted Trump's, or at least part of Trump's second travel ban. They allowed all of it except for foreign nationals with family, jobs, or school in the U.S. So some kind of a relationship with the United States. And the temporary halt to refugees and general ban on travel from the select Muslim majority countries will be allowed to go into effect immediately.
Boo. At least they are letting students back into school.
Right.
Because that's been, I mean, these kids have been in limbo for...
Well, one of the biggest reasons this travel ban got stays was the fact that there were people traveling for work or who went home for a break from school who couldn't come back.
Yeah, not to mention, the work people, scientists, researchers,
scientists
teachers.
Who'd gone to conferences, tech people who had gone to do recruiting.
Yeah.
So
all it took was going on vacation at the wrong time and bam, couldn't go home.
So this does mean, though, that if you are from the if you are a foreigner from one of those countries and you are already in the country and you have family here, a job, or are going to school, you can travel back and forth. If you don't, then you're screwed.
Yeah, so there's still all of those people. This includes like refugees and...
Oh, new refugees cannot be settled for the next 90 days.
Ah, I see.
Oh, and what's funny here is the rest of the travel ban is going to be reviewed during the next Supreme Court session when it will already be expired.
Yeah, wait a second. I'm like 90 days, 1, 2, 3. That doesn't work.
Even the 120-day refugee one, I think it's 120. That'll be over by the time it's done.
Yeah.
But it's not all bad from the Supreme Court. Arkansas had a law that required that a new mom's husband be listed on the birth certificate, regardless of whether or not he was the biological father, such as would be the case with donor sperm. However, no provision was made for married same-sex parents, and two lesbian couples sued when health officials refused to put the non-biological parent's name on the birth certificate. The Supreme Court ruled that the state was in violation of the Obergefell decision, with Chief Justice Roberts joining with the five who made the majority in that previous ruling.
If you're going to get the rights of marriage, you get all the rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's even bigger with this is this signifies that John Roberts recognizes that this is a done deal.
Yeah.
He voted against same-sex marriage, but now it's done. It's settled. It is what it is.
It is a law.
And when you have a 6-3 majority, that's pretty firm. Granted, there are enough Supreme Court justices over 80 that, or approaching 80, that could change. That's terrifying. But yeah, this is, yeah, with when it comes to rules about marriage, you cannot discriminate based on gender. That is the ruling. You get all the privileges.
Plus, it's a weird rule anyway, that you have to have the husband, whether he's a biological father or not. That's just weird, because wouldn't you want the biological parent on there?
You have, well,
if you can.
If you can, but the assumption is that, well, the two scenarios where that would come into play would be with donor sperm, IVF, something like that, where the biological father is likely unknown.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And the alternative is, or the other scenario would be a case of cheating, which the father may or may not know about. So this just brings up, the whole point of it would be most likely, you don't ask those questions. You just do it. Here's mom, here's her husband. You just put him down. The other factor with it is trying to avoid kids being bastards when they have married parents. Unless the parents are gay. And that's dumb.
Is bastards like still a thing?
In some states.
That's a little backwards.
I don't think it actually has any real legal merit or standing, but yeah.
I can totally see somebody getting screwed over by that, though.
Mm-hmm. Getting screwed out of their inheritance.
Yeah.
Since that's what the whole thing is all about. Yeah. And from another Supreme Court ruling, 7-2, the Supreme Court sided with Trinity Lutheran Church from Columbia, Missouri, and the churches claim that the state discriminated against them by denying them grant money that they would otherwise be eligible for to resurface their playground. At issue was a state law that prohibits any state money from being given to a church for any reason. Interestingly, Gorsuch and Thomas thought the majority didn't go far enough and wrote their concurring opinion that was just insane. And Sotomayor and Ginsburg were the dissenters, and the concurring opinion and the dissent actually used a lot of the same language with opposite conclusions.
Well, I do see it as a slippery slope, which is, I think, what Ginsburg was writing.
Actually, it was Sotomayor who wrote the dissent.
Oh, okay. So, okay. You let them have a playground that's basically on a private property, then, you know, then they can challenge for the next grant, and who knows how much money ends up getting funneled to charter schools or other religious schools.
Mm-hmm.
It could be open a floodgate of lawsuits.
Right. One of the issues with it is the fact that churches don't pay taxes, not even property taxes.
Yeah, so why are they getting qualified for grant money if they don't even pay taxes into...
Most other nonprofits don't as well. Some do. It all depends on the jurisdiction. But yeah, churches don't pay taxes, and they're getting this grant money. But the bigger issue with the slippery slope is the distinction that's being made. This was a very narrow ruling, but just like Hobby Lobby was a very narrow ruling, it's going to have broader application. And the rationale behind the narrow ruling was that they were unfairly singling out this playground because it was owned by a church. And they made the distinction that, no, of course you couldn't give them money if it was a part of their ministry. But this is a playground that they have that's not necessarily a part of the ministry. So what's next? Church gymnasiums? Church schools? And especially since this playground was part of a explicitly Christian ministry preschool.
Yeah, that's kind of a big hook.
So there's that angle on the slippery slope. And the other is, as you let more and more government money get into church, government has more and more reason and justification to control the church. Strong separation between church and state is actually better for the believer than it is for the non-believer.
It's better for everyone.
But it's great for everyone. Because if you look at, by the time it gets to charter schools and vouchers, eventually those voucher programs, which are going to start out really vague and with few strings, well, once kids start getting into college and they don't know basic things they're supposed to, like evolution, you're going to start getting some strings. With if you can give government funds, if it's not directly used for ministry purposes, and you have a religious school that, say, 6 out of the 7 hours of the day is doing secular studies, and that 1 hour of the day they're doing a Bible class, then you can provide a voucher for 6/7 of the tuition cost. And that's going to be a little bit weird. But then...
weird, it doesn't even begin to describe it.
But then, what if health class doesn't teach comprehensive sex ed? Are you then down to 5/7? And if biology doesn't cover evolution and they teach a little bit of creationism, then are you down to 4/7? And if you actually start putting in requirements like that onto a religious school, you're going to be influencing the doctrine they are teaching with financial incentive. They don't know what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah, church money needs to stick with churches, and government money needs to stick with government, because you don't want meddling from both sides.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Lauren, are you going to take off now?
I am.
Okay. Lauren, thank you for joining me for the first half of the show.
Yay!
And then we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have Scott Smith.
We love hearing from our listeners. You can email us at contact@atheistnomads.com, tweet us @atheistnomads, send us a message on our Facebook page at facebook.com/atheistnomads, or better yet, call us and leave us a message at 541-203-0666. We might even play it on the show. You can also help us out by leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast directory of choice.
We are now joined by Scott Smith from Recovering from Religion. It may seem like he is coming halfway through the show, but I asked people to join since Lauren had a headache and Wesley is missing. I asked, like, when I started recording. And Scott, you jumped on pretty damn fast. Thank you.
That's me. I'm here to serve.
All right. How have you been?
I've been pretty good. It's only 400 degrees here in Texas today, but other than that, we're doing pretty good.
It was a nice cool about 85 here in Boise. We had the heat wave come through, and now it's cooled down.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So I guess you read the news today about Kentucky?
Oh, yeah. I've got that one down in the show notes, which you don't have.
Yeah, and I'm originally from Kentucky, born and raised there. Yeah,
okay.
Live in Texas now, but spent most of my early life in Kentucky. And I gotta say, I'm not surprised at all. Of course, they're going to teach the Bible in public schools. This comes to no surprise to me whatsoever at all. And what's really a shame is taxpayer money is going to buy Bibles for the students to read, and they're going to pay for a teacher to teach them these Bibles that were written by men who didn't know where the sun went at night. And
right.
They're going to teach them in place of something else that would do them a lot more good. I know it's an elective, but it could be a dental science class or another foreign language or anything that would benefit them. And instead, they'll be teaching them the Bible.
Right. All right. So let me give you the for our listeners, the full introduction on this. Kentucky's Governor Matt Bevin opened a bill signing with prayer, not the usual way of starting. The bill is HB 128, and it allows public schools at each district's discretion to teach Bible classes. These classes will be considered social studies and must be electives. And if they're considered social studies, they will likely count for social studies credit. And why did this law pass? Well, according to Representative DJ Johnson, and I'll let you guess which party he is with,
It really did set the foundation that our founding fathers used to develop documents like the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. All those came from principles in the Bible. Really? No, go ahead.
For your listeners listening 100 years in the future, that the year is 2017 here on Earth, and we're still doing shit like this.
Yeah, yeah. Somehow in the 240 years that we're up to now since the founding of this country, the mostly deistic Enlightenment figures that founded the country have been revised to be Bible-believing conservative evangelical Christians.
Yeah, and, you know, here's the thing. I mean, Kentucky has an ark. All right, it cost $101 million. And being from Kentucky, I can tell you that there's a lot of things they could have spent that money on that would have done a lot more good. And probably when it's all said and done, hiring teachers to teach the Bible in school and paying for Bibles for these students to study is probably going to be a whole lot more than $101 million. And being someone who has studied the Bible in college, it's not easy. If you want to get a passing grade in this class, you're going to have to dedicate a considerable amount of time in studying. And this is going to take away time from studying math and science, you know, stuff they really could use. And it boggles the mind. Part of me is not surprised they did something like this, but it's still sad.
Yeah. You know, I went to private Adventist schools from third grade on, and I had Bible classes all the way through. Every single year for an hour, 50 minutes every day, there was some kind of a Bible class. And that even applied at Adventist colleges, that everybody had to get at least a certain number of religious studies credits. And it was enough that if you needed an easy minor, take a couple extra classes and you got a religion minor. And that's the way the school was. And you miss out on extra stuff because that takes up, you don't get electives when you lose out on time for stuff like that. Because you still have to follow the rest of the curriculum, and it just takes away from other classes.
Right. And the religious folks are going crazy in Kentucky right now. I have several friends that are celebrating like they just won the Super Bowl. And they are so happy about this because their kids and grandkids get to learn about the Bible in classroom and mm-hmm. also in church and at home, we know where they should be learning about it if they care to. I mean, why don't we pass a bill that we can teach science and evolution in the church? That would be along the same lines. Why don't we pass a bill that we also have to teach the Quran in public schools, maybe the Torah, and maybe the gospel according to the Flying Spaghetti Monster? If they did that, I have no problem with it.
Idaho has a social studies unit on world religions, and you have to cover all of the major religions. I have been a guest instructor for that a couple of times at a local school here in the Treasure Valley, and that's actually really cool because they get to learn about Christianity, they get to learn about Islam, they get to learn about Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism, and when they get me, they get to learn about the Sikhs and the Jains. And it's amazing when you see these conservative Idaho, probably Mormon or Catholic kids getting really excited about Hindu philosophy and the baptism of the sword that Sikhs have. And you get the questions from the Catholics of, are Mormons really Christians? And all the Mormons look waiting for you to say yes, ready to crucify you if you don't. And it's really cool. But that's not what this is. This is just straight up a Bible class, where they're probably going to teach it as fact, not just as literature. Officially, the class is a Bible literacy class, but there is a very, very narrow band that they can teach that in without violating the law.
We talked to David G. McAfee, who wrote a couple of kids' books, the Book of Gods and the Belief Books. And the main takeaway from that is, if you're bringing your kid up in a secular household and you don't talk to your kids about gods, someone will. But it won't be gods like plural. It'll be their God, you know, the one true right God. So he would love to see a religious studies class be offered in high school that would teach kids all the modern religions and maybe past religions. And I can tell you, down here in Texas, there's no way they would stand for one day of the Quran being taught. There would be an uproar. I mean, they would boycott classes of that day. It would be terrible. Okay, they wouldn't stand for that. Just like in Kentucky when they built the Ark Park with a lot of tax funder, a lot of tax money. If someone wanted to build Islam World in Kentucky with tax money, there's no way they would approve that. But since it's the Ark, of course, yeah, sure, no problem. Even though it's unconstitutional against the law, yeah, go ahead and do it.
Right. You know, last year at the Hyde Park Street Fair in Boise's North End, Lauren and I got to hear about how they're teaching Sharia law in Idaho schools. I'm guessing they were talking about the World Religions unit in middle school, where, yes, Sharia law is addressed. It is being taught as a fact that some people practice law based on Islam. That is okay. Telling kids that they have to live under that, that would be illegal.
Right.
A Bible literacy class done absolutely perfectly, where it is literature, it is to be read as literature, and none of it is assumed to be true, is perfectly legal.
Right.
The moment you start teaching it as this is fact, you just broke the law.
Yeah, and there's no easy answer. I mean, someone's going to be pissed off no matter what they decide. You know, probably lawyers are benefiting more than anybody else because they're guaranteed to make money.
Oh, yeah.
And for years and decades.
And the schools are going to lose.
Yeah, exactly. And what state was it today that someone knocked over the Ten Commandments?
That's the next story.
What's that?
That's the next story.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. Sorry about that. But yeah, when I was in middle school in Kentucky, the eighth grade, we learned about the planets and memorized the nine planets. We had nine planets in the solar system back then. And we thought we were big shots, you know. And I remember asking my science teacher, what's beyond Pluto? And he said, well, we don't know. We'll probably never know. Probably heaven or something like this. And he was a science teacher. Now, granted, that was in the 70s and it was in Kentucky, but he was a science teacher. And I never forgot that. And I would say if I could go back into every middle school science class in Kentucky, even today, I would bet there's a good portion that would say roughly the same thing. Even though we have the Hubble telescope and lots of other telescopes, it's brought us so much knowledge about what else is out there. They would probably say about the same thing. I'm willing to bet money.
Yeah. Well, I grew up Adventist, so I knew where heaven was. It's through the middle of Orion's belt.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go ahead. And I just sent you the link to the show notes in the Zencastr chat.
Gotcha.
Arkansas passed Act 1231 in 2015 that called for the placement of a Ten Commandments monument to be placed somewhere on the state capitol grounds. Since they've been fighting to actually be allowed to do it and have rejected applications to put in a brick wall, I'm guessing FFRF wanted that, and a Baphomet statue that the Satanists wanted. And then after less than 24 hours of getting the installment finished, a man who identifies as a born-again Christian and a Jesus freak, and who is possibly the same person who drove into Oklahoma's Ten Commandments, and who is also allegedly schizophrenic, drove into the Ten Commandments in Arkansas. This is just glorious.
So what you're saying is he wasn't an atheist?
Nope. A Christian.
He was a Christian?
A Christian destroyed it.
No, wait a second. He couldn't have been a real Christian.
Well, actually, I would, based on the information they have about in the article from Arkansas Online that we have linked to in the show notes, the statue has an American eagle, the all-seeing eye of God, and those are both above the Ten Commandments. So you could easily say the all-seeing eye of God, that is a pagan Freemason symbol, like the one on our money. That's satanic. And you've got the American eagle. That's saying that the state is above the church. And the actual Ten Commandments they used for it are an exact replica of the ones from the movie, The Ten Commandments. And of course, Hollywood is run by a bunch of Jews and atheists.
Oh, yeah.
So that's evil as well. So I can totally see how a Christian would be totally against this monument. There's also a lot of Christians who really like church-state separation.
Yeah. So the guy rammed his truck into this, destroying, I don't know how much it cost, probably a few $1,000, taxpayers' money, of course, and he's in jail, probably.
They did get some donations to help pay for it originally.
Okay.
This monument was made from, actually, no, it was 4,000 pounds. It was a slab of mahogany granite.
So it probably did a fair amount of damage to the guy's vehicle, and he's going to jail.
Yep.
Okay, well, whether he's Christian or another religion or atheist, it sounds like he's got some issues going on. And, you know, I'm sorry, but every time something like this happens or there's a mass shooting, the first thing that goes through my mind is, please don't be an atheist. Please don't be an atheist. And, you know, so far, we're doing pretty good. And unfortunately, the tragedy is just as tragic and the body count is just as high. And it's a shame. But yeah, the guy probably has some issues, according to the report. So hopefully he gets the help he needs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I am rearranging the stories because that is the perfect segue into the next. The new next, a new report looking at terrorist incidents in the U.S. has found that in the last 9 years, right-wing terrorists have been involved in 115 incidents, with police stopping 35%, while Islamic terrorists have been involved in 63 incidents, with 76% being stopped.
Well, I'm reminded that 96% of statistics are completely incorrect, but you know, what's terrorism? It's a crime. And have we ever stopped crime? Will we ever stop crime? We can make it harder for someone to commit a crime with cameras and technology and DNA and stuff like that, but it's never going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think terrorism will ever stop unless religion is completely faded away. And that's not going to happen in our lifetimes.
And that won't stop it either.
Yeah, there's always going to be hate, and it's unfortunate. And there's also going to be mental health issues involved with that, even if it's not really diagnosed. I think that's a big part of it.
Like we talked about in the last episode, which you weren't here for, I firmly believe that the biggest factor is people get frustrated, they get angry, and they feel powerless. So they lash out violently. If, you know, if you look at, for a comparison, you ask any pizza delivery person, what breed of dog is most likely to bite you? It's Chihuahuas. They are small and they are terrified. And so if they can try to make themselves look bigger by being really yippy and biting, they might actually win.
Mm-hmm.
Pit bulls get all the blame, but they don't actually bite that many people. They get reported more than any others because people are afraid of pit bulls. And it's you get kind of that same thing. People who have power, who have privilege, who feel represented by the government, who are employed, are not likely to protest and are not likely to actually resort to violence. Those who are disenfranchised will. And if you have time, you protest. If you're disenfranchised and you don't have much time, you just might react with violence.
I think it makes a lot of sense. You may be on something there. It's very easy to criticize if you're upper middle class and you've got a pretty good life. It's pretty easy to look down on those who are lashing out. And you can't condone it. I mean, you know, hurting someone or destroying property is never cool. Mm-hmm. But if you try to understand why they're doing that instead of just, you know, reading the headline, okay, someone committed a crime or hurt someone or destroyed something, we'll probably be a little bit better off if we just try to understand why they're doing that.
Right. And if you look at, you know, we watch the headlines pretty close to do Atheist Nomads, and we see every single Islamic terrorist incident in the news. I think I've seen one or two right-wing terrorist incidents. Apparently they're happening and they're just not making the news. And that shows where people are watching. Just like with the Chihuahua versus the Pitbull, every single bite from a Pitbull gets reported to the police. Hardly anybody is willing to admit they got bit by a Chihuahua.
Right. And a pretty good example, I think it was last week in, I want to say England, there was a bunch of Muslims coming out of the mosque.
Yep.
And someone ran over them with a van. And obviously they weren't Islamic, the guy behind the wheel. Probably Christian, but...
Or an atheist.
Yeah.
This is Britain we're talking about.
Right. No, if they were atheists, believe me, that would be front page news. Okay.
Yeah, that's fair.
They never identified how he identified.
Right.
And he was probably Christian. And I can't guarantee that, but I can guarantee if he was atheist, that would be front page news. He lives in Britain. He was probably Christian. That never was reported at all.
Right.
And I think it was about 2 years ago, maybe three. In Florida, there were three Muslims killed by an atheist. And they looked on his Facebook page, and he read stuff by Richard Dawkins, and he belonged to all these atheist groups, and he killed these three Muslims. Well, it was over a parking lot dispute. Now, it's still a tragedy. The three dead are still just as dead. But it's not too much of a story if it's over a parking lot dispute. But if they determine that he killed the Muslims because he was an atheist and he didn't like Muslims, then that's a huge story. And it kind of faded away.
Yep. All right. Well, let's go ahead and take our last break. And then we actually have a very heartwarming story about how to deal with terrorism.
As a listener of the show, I'm going to assume you love my sexy vocal stylings. If you love the rest of the show as much as my voice, consider giving us the resources we desperately need to purchase quality cocaine and Red Bull. We make it super easy to make a one-time donation or to support us on a per-episode, monthly, or even annual basis using PayPal or Patreon. Find out more at atheistnomads.com. Use the links on the right side of the page. A dollar an episode is all we ask.
With as much news as we look at, I've gotten pretty callous at reading news stories. This one got to me. An Iraqi police officer in Babel saw a suicide bomber heading for a mosque, so he hugged him, keeping the terrorist from entering the building and saving dozens of lives. When the suicide bomber hit the detonate, it was just the police officer and the bomber who died.
Well, that's a true sacrifice, without question. And, I can tell you, I've been to Iraq, and there's a lot of good and bad going on there. And you hear about the bad. You don't hear too much about the good. And there are good people there who will do stuff just like this. And this probably wasn't, you know, front page news, but if the guy got in and killed 100 people, that would have been front page news. So, the ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah. He's straight up a hero. We've seen more stories about Iraqi police officers and military running in the face of ISIS. We don't see all that many stories about heroes. I hope in their own media they do, because everybody needs heroes, especially when you're in a pretty shitty situation.
Yeah. And, you know, there it's the Shias against the Sunnis. And, you know, to one, the other is not a hero, vice versa. But, you know, from the outside looking in, he saved lives. It doesn't matter if there's Shia or Sunnis. That guy saved lives. And yeah, any way you want to look at it, he's a hero.
Yeah. It's sad that he died, but amazing. All right, let's go ahead and move on to... Oh, man, I just keep rearranging the stories. Gonna do it again, because a new order makes more sense now. It's been nearly a 20-year tradition since Clinton started it for presidents to host an Eid dinner to mark the close of Ramadan. Bush and Obama both followed the tradition, and Trump decided to pass.
You know, normally I would say it's a political thing if it's any other president of recent history. And if they did something like this, I would say, okay, they got political reasons with Trump. Who knows? He might have had a tea time. It's anybody's guess.
Oh, he did play golf instead.
Maybe it is political reasons. Maybe he's, you know, starting to run the numbers. And, you know, he's come out and said that we're all made by his God. He's come out during the campaign and said he's going to make stores say Merry Christmas. So maybe this is the first of many things to come.
Yeah. He's also, every chance he's gotten, denigrated Muslims. And this is another chance to give them the finger. Now, on the one hand, I think it is ridiculous and stupid for presidents to be hosting religious observances. That should not be a thing. But if he is passing on this, I definitely hope he didn't host an Easter service or any kind of Easter celebration. And I hope he won't be hosting any Jewish celebrations, although I'm sure his son-in-law will encourage him to do that. And I hope he won't do anything for Christmas, but we'll have to see if he's being fair or if he's just being an asshole.
You're hoping for a whole lot there. You know, the National Day of Prayer, all this. Yeah, that's all a go, I'm sure. But I don't know. I would love to see a president just not do any of those things. But, you know, when you got 70% of your voters Christian, then 99% of the elected officials will be Christian. And that's just the way it is in the year 2017.
Yeah. Well, and if you reach out to Jews and Muslims, then obviously you're going to be in with the, at least earn some points with the liberals.
Right.
It's a way of having your cake and eating it too.
Well, you know, Islam's the fastest growing religion on the planet. And, you know, in the U.S., it's skyrocketing, you know, especially in Michigan and other places. So eventually they're going to have a seat at the table and they're going to be voters. And if you want to get elected, you got to find a way to cater to Christians and Muslims or else. You can't get elected unless you have the majority of votes for both religions.
Yep.
But, you know, I'm not smart enough to tell anybody who to vote for at all. Now, Bruce Springsteen is. He has very keen political insight that no one else has. Now, I got to tell you, if I paid $100 to see him and he stopped the show to talk about politics, I would be very pissed off. I mean, I've gone there for music, not to hear politics. I don't want to hear politics at a concert.
Alrighty. Vice President Mike Pence spoke at the 40th anniversary celebration for Focus on the Family, and I'm not going to play the full 5 minutes because it's basically all the same drivel. So let me summarize it for you. Donald Trump hates women, is doing everything he can to fight abortion, kill Planned Parenthood, and make sure nobody gets access to health care. But he loves Christians.
Mm.
Go Jesus.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, our vice president is in favor of gay conversion therapy, okay? And I hate to keep repeating myself, but the year is 2017. And, you know, what do you expect? I mean, there you go. He's in favor of gay conversion therapy.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure it's going to be covered by the new healthcare bill or not. It's probably in there somewhere.
No, I think they're mostly on the cut. It's got Planned Parenthood, cut
Medicaid. They've got cut the subsidies for the healthcare exchanges and make all of the essential services optional. Because why should a man have to pay for prenatal care? Well, I've got two good reasons for you. If you're straight and you have kids, you've benefited from that. I am benefiting from prenatal care right now because I have a pregnant wife. And if you were born, which I'm pretty sure every human was, you benefited from prenatal care. Or if you didn't, you would have if it had been available for you. And when it benefits literally 100% of the population, and when we have a rising maternal mortality rate in the United States, and we have some states with a maternal mortality rate higher than places in Central America. Okay, actually, there's some places. Costa Rica has a fucking amazing healthcare system. Higher than places that are at the depths of despair in the middle of the drug war. We have a problem. And cutting access to that care isn't going to help.
That's very true.
And some of the new reports that have been coming out, studies looking into it, tens of millions of people are going to lose healthcare coverage, and millions more per year will die.
That's probably very true. And I'm about to piss off probably about 3/4 of your listeners, but that's what I do best. And I can tell you that any doctor is going to say whatever they come up with isn't going to work because it's based on the health factor of 2017. Because the health factor 20 years from now isn't going to be the same as it is today. 30 years ago, roughly a third of our population was overweight or obese. Today, it's 2/3 and it's growing. And any doctor will tell you that excess body weight will definitely increase the chances of major health issues to include cancer. And doctors are treating kids today that they once only treated issues with adults like hypertension. When your 10-year-old has hypertension, there's a problem there. And it's going to lead to major health issues. So I would love to see more focus on health than health care. That's where we need to focus the main energy on, because, you know, no one's going to get elected by saying I'm going to raise taxes to pay for health care. And it's just not going to happen. It doesn't add up. You can't have it all.
If you campaign against Camel and Coca-Cola, they will destroy you.
Right.
We need to get corporate money out of politics to be able to do that. In the meantime, we're stuck with fixing the damage that's been done.
Right. And people are living longer, but they're not living, you know, healthier. Life expectancy keeps going up. Although I've read stuff where they're saying for the first time in history, the life expectancy is going to go down in a few years. And we've done that to ourselves, and that's through sugar and fat, and our diets are crappy. Our activity level is crappy. We sit behind desks all day and we eat really bad, and that's the major problem. But people don't want to hear that. They want the easy answer.
No, if you want to cut the cost of healthcare, if we were able to stop smoking and obesity overnight, 80% of all healthcare would be unnecessary.
Right. You're absolutely right. If we could get every fast food restaurant to have good, healthy foods, we would solve this problem real quick. But we can't do that because we might be able to get one fast food chain to do that. Mm-hmm. But they would quickly go out of business because the other fast food restaurant across the street hasn't, you know, clammed on board with that. So they'll make money and the other one that serves healthy foods go out of the business.
Yeah.
So how can we solve this?
Well, get the money out of politics.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a good start. The smoking issue is one that the only solution I've heard that actually makes sense is you set a final date of birth that you can smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So you decide if you were born after, you know, let's say right now, 2017, if you were born after January 31st, 2000, you can never legally buy cigarettes. You make it so that, yeah, you're going to have people who are going to be cheating the system to get in on that. And then maybe 10 years down the road, you grandfather in a few more, but you start making it something that you have to take it out of the cultural norm. And that's a multi-generational thing. We're already part of the way there. We need to keep pushing it. And if you put one of those drop dead dates, yeah, you're writing off a couple generations. But if you look at the stats on the average smoker starting at 13, and if you start smoking before 18, odds are you will never be able to break your nicotine addiction, ever. The current approaches at stopping smoking won't work. Stopping people who are already smoking is always going to fail. You look at somebody who's decided they're going to they stop smoking unless they find an alternative. In my case, it was switching to vaping. I haven't had a cigarette in over 4 years. Most smokers who try to quit without some kind of a possibly permanent crutch will always go back. And when they try to quit, they're probably going to quit quitting. And then they'll quit again. And then they'll quit quitting again. And it'll just create that cycle. And with diet, I have no fucking clue how to fix that.
Well, let's think about this.
We're talking
let's
culture.
Say, yeah. Let's say I was running for president and I said, okay, if your kid is obese, we're going to give him some time to lose the weight. And if he doesn't, I'm going to take him out of your house and you're going to pay more taxes and you're not going to see your kid hardly ever. I'll never be elected president because I've just lost over 2/3 of the potential vote.
Oh, I'd say more than that, because almost all those policies end up being regressive in nature and that they hurt the poor more than the rich.
Right. But if I said, okay, everybody, for every household who weighs in at a healthy weight, and you'd have to have a doctor sign off on that and establish guidelines, for every family that weighs in at a healthy weight, you're going to receive $500. All of you will receive t-shirts and a certificate suitable for framing. Well, then we got some people motivated, and there's the mentality of, if I have something, $500 and t-shirts, and my neighbor sees that, that might motivate my neighbor to get in shape, join the gym, eat less, and get healthier because, hey, I've got $500 for being skinny, and next year he can too. I think that that's more the approach to take.
Interesting idea. Unfortunately, we're over time on the regular show. So we're gonna have to leave that there. We do have a few more stories to cover for patrons only. And, if you're willing to stick around, Scott, that would be awesome.
Sure.
All right. So for our listeners on the regular feed, Scott, where can our listeners find you regularly?
You can find us at recoveringfromreligion.org. Our helpline number is 1-844-I-DOUBT-IT. You can call us, you can schedule a call, you can chat if that's more comfortable for you, and you can find our podcast on iTunes and anywhere else, and you can even arrange for my co-host Emily to call you up and read the transcript for you word for word with smooth jazz in the background. That's always an option for an additional fee only. So keep that in mind, and recoveringfromreligion.org. Check out the resources we have.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.